Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Anne Druan. She's the Emmy and Peabody Award winner who co-wrote the PBS documentary series Cosmos, which was hosted by her husband, the late Carl Sagan. Her new book, Cosmos: Possible Worlds, is a companion to the documentary series of the same name that debuts this month on National Geographic. And you've devoted your life to the communication of science, but how does someone who communicates about science differ from someone who describes herself as merely a scientist?
Well, I'm not a scientist, and I think that's something that really helps me in communicating science, because I'm one who, for the first part of my life, felt effectively excluded from science. I couldn't do the math, and I just felt left out. And it wasn't until my life with Carl that I began to understand that science is a collection of stories, and there are ways into even the most complex ideas that all of us can understand, and by doing so, have an enhanced experience of life in the universe.
But to understand science, you have to do your own research and try to put that in a language that is communicatable, if that's even a word, to the general mass audience. So that involves quite a bit of interpretation on your part, right?
Absolutely. I plead guilty to that. But of course, both for the series and the book, I have been lucky enough be able to pick the brains of dozens of distinguished scientists, and not only that, to have them vet the book and the series before it goes to press or is broadcast. So, where I go wrong, in those places where I and my co-writer Brandon Braga have made a misstep, we're very lucky to be set right by those who know much more than either of us do.
The word cosmos, I always think of Carl Sagan and the TV series when I hear it, no matter how it's used, but it has an actual meaning. What does the word cosmos actually mean?
It's a Greek word, and it's sort of the opposite of chaos, actually. It's the Greeks suspected or intuited that there was an order to the universe, and they were right. There are laws of nature that we can understand. And not only that, but those laws are a foundation on which we can build much more knowledge. And, of course, the founders of science, the ancient Ionian Greeks, Democritus, Heraclitus, Hippocrates, all of those people, they made a decision that they were going to try to understand nature without resorting to the explanation that it's because the gods want this. And that was a revolution in thought. For me, it's as great a revolution as when life left the water for the land. It became a completely different planet. And everything ever since, really, has been building on that one supposition, and look where it's taken us. It's made it possible for us to send spacecraft to the stars, but in some sense, it's also brought us to the many challenges that we now face.
Before the Cosmos series came about on PBS, had other scientific popularizers, for lack of a better term, come along throughout the ages?
Yes, in some sense, you could, if you think of the birth of science, of modern science, as something that begins perhaps when Galileo takes his first look through a telescope. Galileo wrote books, and there have been many great scientists like Carl, who also chose to communicate their gifts of science. In fact, it was Einstein who inspired me to do this series and the book. He was opening the 1939 New York World's Fair, momentous occasion. He was talking to 200,000 people in the rain at the same time as there was a national hookup. And he said, if science is ever to fulfill its mission as fully as art already has, its inner meaning must penetrate to the consciousness of the people. What a remarkable statement that is. When I found that, you know, just surfing around on YouTube one night a few years ago, I realized that that was always the dream of Cosmos. Every season of Cosmos is about that dream. It's about tearing down the walls that alienate so many of us from science and making it possible for the world. After all, this book, this series is going to be shown in 172 countries around the world next week. And so just imagine a world of informed decision makers armed with the baloney detection kit that science provides so that they can't be so easily manipulated and lied to. And that's the dream of Cosmos, that we would all know, you know, something of the wonders of nature that only science has been able to reveal.
In the 40 years or so since this Cosmos industry has been around, how has the communication of science changed as people's tastes have changed? And I'm thinking specifically of the YouTube generation now, where people are used to getting a full story in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it feels like our metabolism has really speeded up since Carl and I and Steven Soder wrote the first Cosmos series. What Carl and I always felt was that we didn't necessarily want to reach those people who were already interested in science, doing science, teaching science. That, you know, we felt that they were already fine. What we wanted to do was touch the people who didn't realize that they even had any kind of talent or inclination to understand these ideas. And so, you know, that's really Cosmos is for all kinds of people. Gotten a lot of positive reinforcement from many, many scientists. But the way that the presentation of science has really changed is that Carl Sagan made it respectable to go to the public. He always said, when asked, because he had such a vigorous scientific career, you know, he was always asked, like, why are you running around and doing these shows and going to these naturalization ceremonies, you know, with such energy to talk about science? And he always said, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. And that's how I feel, too. I feel that the audience that watches the show or reads the book is going to emerge potentially more powerful. We feel powerless at this moment, all of us do, because the challenges we're facing are so daunting. But we're not powerless. And this kind of understanding of our situation, of nature, of the great possibilities of the future, of a future that we can still have, because we're all descended from people who had their backs to the wall countless times, and because they stood up to the challenge, that's why you and I are here. So Cosmos, I hope, is empowering not only in the scientific information that it imparts painlessly in the course of a very dramatic story, but also, you know, the optimism that I feel based on what I've learned.
I'm chatting with Ann Druann about her new book, which is a companion to the series of the same name, Cosmos: Possible Worlds. And as we look at this, as I was reading through the book, you ask a question that I'd never thought about before, because it seems like a fundamental question for what you do. You ask, is the universe knowable in our brain comprehension with respect to that? I never thought about that as the way our brains works, but is there a limitation on what we can learn scientifically just because of how we are made as human beings?
That's great. Now you're asking a really deep question, because, of course, in the quantum realm, you know, classical physics is correct. but it did not suspect the existence of a realm beyond classical physics. And there was another achievement of Einstein's. The stories of some of the other people we tell, they were the first to glimpse that hole in the curtain covering the matrix. And so, yes, there's a possibility of seeing beyond. You're asking if our brains can deal with, let's say, the quantum realm or the realms beyond that we haven't even begun to suspect are there. And that's an excellent question to which I do not know the answer. I just know that in writing the chapter and the episode with Brandon Braga for the show on the quantum realm, it was for me like seeing an optical illusion where for seconds at a time you can make out one image and then you lose it and now you can only see the other image. It was the most challenging episode that we wrote. And yet, when it was over, we felt that we had demystified and found a way in to the mystery of quantum physics.
Another thing that you address in the book is the idea of intelligent life being somewhere out there in the heavens and whether or not we're ready for it. Have you come to any conclusions for yourself that you would have any idea what you would do if you had an encounter with intelligent life from another planet?
Well, I feel ever since I had the honor of being the creative director of the Voyager Interstellar Message, I have been thinking about this. I was 27 back then, and now I'm 70. So I've given this a lot of thought. And, I'd like to think so, because I think there's such a thing as convergent evolution. And we see this demonstrated time and again among the life forms of Earth. And it's my view, first of all, that spacefaring extraterrestrials, the ones we imagine, they're not likely to want to come here for lunch to eat us. They're not likely to want to destroy what we have. There's a kind of cosmic quarantine that I think virtually all, if there's life elsewhere in the universe, intelligent life, they were subjected to that same cosmic quarantine. Here we are as a species struggling through our technological adolescence. Things look grim, but having been a very unruly adolescent and having known and raised a couple myself, I have to say that we all kind of look like we're not going to get it together at some point in our lives. But then we mature, and it seems to me that any spacefaring civilization that's ironed out the enormous challenges of traveling over long periods of time, over unimaginably vast distances, they've likely to mature also. We always imagine them to be technologically superior to us, but emotionally and spiritually inferior or as stunted as we are. And I think that's an error in logic. And so, I would hope that an extraterrestrial and I could connect, that the grandeur of the cosmos and the fragility and preciousness of life would be a bond between us.
The one thing that I looked at before I started reading the book, and I've gone back and looked at it several times since then, is the cosmic calendar. You have this in the front. This is something I've seen before.
Yes.
Through the Cosmos series. But what is the cosmic calendar for people who may not be aware?
Okay, so right at this moment, the scientific community has arrived at a consensus, but it may be subject to revision like everything else, that the universe, that all of time, adds up to 13.8 billion years. 13.8 billion years from the Big Bang to this very moment. Imagine you were to take that time and convert it into a year at a glance calendar to try to wrap your brain around what a vast expanse of time that truly is. So January 1st in the first seconds of January 1st, we have the Big Bang. And New Year's Eve on December 31st is this very moment. And that way you begin to realize, first of all, that, you know, the first galaxies begin to form in March. You know, the sun turns on, I think, in August. The Earth is formed very soon after. But the origin of life is 4 billion years ago, these one-celled organisms of the very beginning. And here we are. Well, we humans have only been, we've only existed for a minute or two on the a few minutes on the cosmic calendar. And the traditions that we cherish are only a few seconds old on the cosmic calendar. All of them, all of the world's great religious traditions, they begin less than 10 seconds ago on the cosmic calendar. That's a very sobering thought, and also a very, I think, an empowering, again, to use that word, an empowering knowledge. You have some coherent and some way to really wrap your brain around the vast expanse of space and time that is the cosmos.
It's an amazing book. It's an amazing series, and looking forward to the reboot. It's Andrew Ann's Cosmos Possible Worlds, the sequel to Carl Sagan's beloved classic. The book's available now wherever your books are sold, and check out the new reincarnation of that series on National Geographic this month. And thank you for your time today.
It was my great pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.